You know, I think that I think it's a relatively new idea that that teachers can, you know, hold knowledge in published articles, that they can hold this information set and that they can share that information set with other people. I certainly couldn't have imagined when I was training as a scientist that the knowledge that I would develop would be from the classroom, would be so deep and so useful, right? That I could leverage all this knowledge so powerfully. And you know, the stories of people working with others and learning things, they're like not new ideas, but I really feel like the way that we are now sort of sharing stories and the way that we are learning from each other as teachers, but also as human beings, has really accelerated and changed in interesting ways.
Welcome to Teacher Voice, the podcast dedicated to bringing you stories by teachers about teaching. Teachers tell stories about their content, about their students, about their communities, about themselves and their colleagues and their contexts. Sometimes this storytelling is motivated by a sense of confidence and achievement, the feeling that we've learned something through our practice that will be useful for others. Some of our stories are driven by emotion on behalf of ourselves or our colleagues or our students. And some of our stories are driven by crisis and conflict. As teachers, we hold knowledge, but we are also constantly building knowledge and seeking knowledge. And we tell stories both to understand and to be understood. Making our teacher stories public can be challenging, both in ways that we expect and in ways that we don't. It's an unpredictable process. Sometimes it's frustrating. Sometimes it's rewarding. It's always urgent. And when we make these stories public, we can't control or predict their effects. My name is Brittany Franskoviak. I teach biology in Central Maryland. I'm in my eighth year at my school, and I'm an associate editor for Kaleidoscope.
My name is Beverly Stuckwish. I've been teaching high school math and chemistry in Ohio for the past 6 years, but it's my first year teaching at my current school, and I'm also an associate editor for Kaleidoscope.
My name is Kirsten Milks. I teach high school science in Bloomington, Indiana, and I love my job. I'm one of the editor-in-chiefs of Kaleidoscope, and I've been a teacher for 9 years now.
Kirsten, I have to say that I've had a lot of respect for you as a teacher and as a writer the whole time I've known you. And I was really surprised recently when you mentioned that you had had this challenging experience with a piece that you had submitted to the American Biology Teacher. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened with the story that you published there?
Yeah, it was probably one of the most intellectually intense times I have ever had thinking about my teaching and my teacher identity. So as part of our work with the Knowles Teacher Initiative, two colleagues and I, Katie Davenport and Becky Van Tassel, worked together to create a lesson series about evolution and about specifically about thinking about understanding tree thinking. So we published this pair of papers in American Biology Teacher. We got reviews back on them and made adjustments based on those kind-hearted reviews. And after those had been out for a little while, we got an email from the editor-in-chief of the American Biology Teacher. And he said, "We've received this critical response to publish. Are you folks interested in writing a response to that response?" And we published these two papers, one from the other author and one from you guys, in the same issue of the journal. I have a lot of science training, and evolution was something that I learned. Talking about evolution and framing evolution with students was something that I learned on the job, and I felt like the rug had been pulled out from under my feet. You know, I'm reading this critical response, and every sentence makes me feel like I know less and less. And I will tell you, those 10 minutes of reading that response and just pausing and reading those responses and pausing. I had to teach afterwards, and they came in and they were like, "Did your dog die?" The students, "Did your dog die?" I was like, "No, I'm fine. I shouldn't look that upset. I'm really sorry. I have some questions that I have to ask myself now based on an email that just came." So after I had calmed down a bit and after we had had a chance to meet, the three of us, we drafted a response that in retrospect I feel pretty good about.
Wait, so what was the actual criticism here? What was it from your articles that this person had noticed and was challenging?
You know, one of the big criticisms from the person who wrote in, and it's a valid criticism, was that we were using vocabulary and just the ways that we talk about evolution in ways that are a bit at odds with some of the traditions of researchers who are currently doing evolutionary biology, which is true. And so we looked back through our sources and we said, yeah, these mistakes or these misconceptions that you cite are cited throughout all the things that we used from the College Board and PBS and Berkeley. So yeah, you are right. That's a place where we all need to grow. And then the second big thing that was challenging was that this writer was writing in from a tradition in evolutionary biology where you look at all the characteristics that you can about organisms, be it DNA data, physical characteristics, what have you, and you count them equally, you weigh them equally as you think about what those evolutionary relationships back in time for the existing organisms would be. And we had built our activity to prioritize certain data that we know to be more reliable, like DNA sequencing and protein sequences.
That's really interesting to me. Certainly when I teach this content to my own students, talking about how we prioritize different sources of data has been almost the crux of what I'm hoping to accomplish when we talk about evolutionary relationships. So I'm just surprised to hear that wasn't the case with this particular expert. And like you, I guess I'm wondering if I've been mistaken or sort of wrong in my thinking about this. But my gut is that teaching students to prioritize these different data sources feels pretty fundamental to me. But I'm not sure that I would know how to push back on someone who is perhaps more credentialed or more authoritative than me as a high school teacher.
And so the first part was this bit where it was like, oh yeah, pedagogically, there just aren't resources for teachers out there that we were able to find and use. And the second part was, well, actually, this is an intellectual difference we have from this really kind-hearted, well-meaning person who's writing in saying this activity is broken, it doesn't work the way you want it to work, it doesn't teach evolution. And so if you look through those three papers, it looks very clean and neat. You know, we wrote this response, it was pretty measured. We felt pretty grateful to the person who had written in and like surfaced this for us. But the stuff that ended up surfacing was all this like shame and frustration and sort of sadness and worry that maybe I wasn't serving my students. And I feel like in most of the rest of my life, I have this like growth mindset about myself and my students and my teaching. And this was a time where I really had developed this sense that I was holding knowledge and that it was valuable. And I really do think that if we hadn't been invited to write the thing, the paper that was going to go alongside this critique of our work, I would still feel really awful about it. And so for me and my colleagues, for Becky and Katie and me, writing this thing was a way to kind of really surface this knowledge that we were holding and to put the critique that came to us like in the bigger context. So it wasn't just like us versus the critique. It was in fact like a bigger picture of scientific thinking and also resources that are available to high school teachers.
Interested that you used the word shame when you were talking about your first like pass at reading this critique that was sent along to you. Why did you choose that? Like, why does that word come to mind for you?
I've been reading a lot of Brené Brown. And I think if you had asked me what feelings I had back whenever that was as I was reading it, I would have stumbled along and not be able to describe it. But Brené Brown's new book, particularly Dare to Lead, has been really instrumental to me this year in being able to say my feelings. And I know now what shame feels like for me. It's the thing where you become very, very narrow and there's a weight in your stomach. That's the thing for me. And so I don't usually think of myself as somebody who is full of shame or vulnerable. And now as a grown-up with a couple more years of teaching and learning and being a grown-up, I'm at the point now where I feel like I have a better sense of that feeling as an instructive personal tool, right? But I mean, here I am. I published 2 papers. I'm feeling really good about this work. I feel awesome for giving back to Knowles because they've given me so much. And here's somebody saying, oh, no, no, no. You didn't really understand the things you did you? And that didn't really square with what I wanted for my own learning or for my classroom. And it was really vulnerable. Yeah, and that makes me think about the piece that Bev wrote that came out recently in Kaleidoscope about her school and about her experience in having difficult and very vulnerable conversations, right? Bev, do you want to tell us a little bit about that experience?
A colleague and I helped some students start a Gay Straight Alliance, and we had expected some opposition or some misunderstandings, I guess, in the community and within the school because it was the first club of that kind in that school and really in that community as well. And we felt like we didn't have a lot of power to make change, I guess, because we were both new teachers in the school and one of a few teachers who didn't grow up in that community and go to that school as a student themselves.
One thing I didn't know about this story for you is that both you and your colleague were folks who didn't grow up in this community.
Yeah, and I realize now that's not something that I really mentioned in that story, but I think that made us feel like we had, I don't know, like kind of like we were outsiders in terms of being able to make change in the school, and that if we did try to make waves, as someone might say, that it wouldn't be viewed in a positive light. Which I think was another assumption that I made, because I'm not sure that ended up being true. So when we did end up having some challenges with the club, I started to get really frustrated, and I started to make a lot of assumptions about my colleagues, about the community, about some of the other students that I was teaching. And I decided to start writing about it just to share my frustrations and more or less to vent with my inquiry partners in Knowles. And when I shared it with them, that's when they brought up to me that, hey, it seems like you've made a lot of assumptions here. You're assuming a lot of opposition here. You're assuming there's not a lot of support for these students. Some of the things that your colleagues have said or some things that have been done, you're making assumptions about what they meant there.
So you take this to your Knowles inquiry group and they look you in the face and they say, Bev, we are here to support and care for you and we got to tell you, it sounds like you're making a bunch of assumptions. What happens after that?
We identified a common thread. We were all avoiding difficult conversations, right? We were friends for a reason. We gravitated toward each other for a reason. And we were conflict avoiders. So we decided to read a book together about how to have difficult conversations. And we each planned one major difficult conversation that we were going to have that we had been avoiding at work. And for me, that involved setting up a group conversation with myself, the administrators, any other colleagues in the school who wanted to come, students from the GSA, a parent came, and any other students who wanted to come just to talk about the purpose of the GSA, how the GSA was viewed in the school, and just basically give everybody a time to kind of just air their thoughts, their frustrations, and what they felt like the GSA needed to do to move forward positively. But I still was really nervous about it and I felt very vulnerable. And because of that, I waited until like the very end of the school year to do it, because if it didn't go well, we'd have the whole summer to kind of like let it blow over. And if it did go well, then we'd have some forward momentum at the start of the next school year.
A big, scary conversation. So what happens?
It did allow a lot of things to air, and I felt like the conversation went really well. It gave students an opportunity to speak, cry in some situations. There were some things that came to light in the conversation that I think for both sides, we were misunderstanding each other, right? So, for example, a colleague had said, well, if there's all this bullying going on in the school, or if there's all these things that are making these students uncomfortable, then they need to be reporting them. And one of the students just flat out said, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to advocate for myself. No one's ever advocated for me. And even like other very well-meaning colleagues reached out to me afterwards and said, I had no idea, you know, that it was this bad for some of these students.
What were some of the things that unsurfaced for you about maybe misconceptions that you or the kids were holding about this issue?
I legitimately thought that there were teachers in the school who just didn't want the GSA to exist, who just were like, this is against my personal or religious or whatever beliefs, and kind of just wanted us to go away. And in those colleagues who I had those thoughts about, I mean, they came to the meeting, right? And they voiced genuine concern for the students, and they listened to what the students had to say. And I'm willing to admit now, and I admit in the article, like, I was wrong about those colleagues. So whatever our differences in beliefs, they genuinely do care about the students. And there was just this crossed lines in communication and how things were being done. And we were all just misunderstanding each other. Do I think everything's perfect now? Probably not. But that conversation, I do think, made things better and allowed the group to move forward.
What a huge learning on your part, right? And on everybody's part. I want to make sure that we check in with you about what the writing process, what the storytelling process about this story, what it was like for you and what you gained from it. You know, I remember you and I took a walk this summer and we were just getting to know each other and you surfaced this story for me. And I remember walking back into our shared meeting space just with goosebumps and being like, that is powerful stuff. And that Bev is like the bravest person I've talked to in a little bit. So what was it like going from, I have this story and I feel it should be told, to actually telling it and having it out there in the world?
I mean, it was a long process, right? Because when I talked to you, at that point, I already felt like I had resolution in this situation and I was ready to start to share this story with others, even though it did feel risky. When I first started writing it, when I first started sharing it with my inquiry partners, that was all prior to that conversation. I didn't feel like there was any resolution for the students or for me yet. And my first couple drafts just sounded really angry and judgmental. And hearing that, reading my own writing, having other people respond to that is what helped me to realize all those assumptions that I had made and what helped me realize there are things I need to address. There are things that I'm avoiding. I can't just not talk to my principal because I don't like the way that he handled one situation when I never really even gave him the opportunity to explain to me why he handled it that way, because I was too emotional to listen at the time, you know? And writing and sharing my writing with others is what helped me to work through the situation and push myself out of my comfort zone and ultimately be able to move forward. And if I hadn't gone through those multiple iterations and really just, it just forced me to think about the entire situation and what I needed to do to move forward. If I hadn't done that, I would still be angry. I wouldn't have been able to move forward.
Yeah, I think that, you know, sometimes writing can be really a really powerful way to explore and resolve some of those really strong emotions and move past them, or like you were able to do in your context, really kind of unpack these assumptions and like learn some really powerful things about how your community operates and kind of move forward from there. I, in a moment of frustration, threw together this article about professional development. And it was at a point in my career where I think I was, I don't know, maybe in year, I must've been in year six of teaching, maybe something like that, five or six. And I was actually at the time, I had a formal leadership role in my building where I was actually, we call it teacher development liaison, but basically it meant that I was a building professional development coordinator. So anytime we had anything going on in the building that was related to professional learning, you know, I would sort of be called in to consult on it or schedule it or facilitate it or, you know, pitch it to staff or modify it to meet our staff's needs or something like that. And it was a job that I was excited about, and there were a lot of things about it that I really appreciated. But there was a lot about it that was super challenging. And so this particular article came out of a day when I was sitting in some professional development, not as a facilitator at that moment, but just as a recipient of this professional development experience. And it was one of those days where it was like August and the kids weren't back yet, and we had, you know, some number of days of meetings prior to the beginning of the school year. And I think literally anyone who's had a teaching job has had the experience of sitting in a meeting and having, you know, seven different tabs open on your browser where you're trying to write three planning calendars and, you know, put together a lab schedule and, you know, reply to some emails. And meanwhile, in front of you is this presentation that is ostensibly to do something to improve your instruction, but really just at that moment for me was not applicable, not urgent, not in my zone of proximal development, not something that I was invested in. I didn't choose to be there. And in this particular case, the people presenting it hadn't chosen to be there either. They were other teachers in my district who had basically been voluntold by some people higher up to present this packaged thing.
We have a moment for that word.
Yeah.
Voluntold.
I'm going to credit Jim Lane with bringing voluntold into my life from an old teacher initiative event some years ago. But so we're sitting there and, you know, like these very unenthusiastic colleagues of mine who, you know, it was one of those things where like no one in the room wanted to be there. No one in the room found it to be a good use of time. And yet there we all were spending this time together, wishing that we were somewhere else. And so what I started doing during that time was crowdsourcing from other teachers, you know, what makes good PD? Because while I was sitting there, I was like, you know, I'm not, and most teachers, I think, genuinely, especially now having like facilitated professional learning for a few years, you know, a lot of teachers really love learning. I mean, that's why we teach. Like, we are learners. That's our thing. It's what we do. We learn and we support others in their learning. And I had grown increasingly frustrated with the perception that many people in administrative positions seem to hold about teachers whenever I interacted with them. There just seemed to be this attitude of like, you know, well, teachers just aren't interested. Like, it's hard to engage teachers in professional learning. They're not interested or invested in this kind of experience. And that particular day, I just kind of snapped and was like, look, it's not that I don't like learning. This is not learning, like what you're offering to me and calling learning. It's not that thing. And I'm not going to call it, like, I'm not going to treat it like it is learning. And so in one sitting, I just spit out this article about what makes good professional development, because the teachers that I polled in my various networks, you know, everyone has had really great professional development experiences. Like, we've had those in our lives, in our professional lives. And that's just such a stark contrast to almost all of the programming that is presented to teachers as being PD at the school or at the district level. And so all of that came out in the piece. And, you know, I don't even really think I drafted it, to be honest. I think I got some feedback when I sent it off to Kaleidoscope, and I honestly don't think I even made the suggested changes. I think I just was like, no, it's fine. I'm not going to mess with it anymore. And maybe that's part of why I'm still angry. Like, perhaps if I had gone back and like reworked it or recouched it. But even now, like, I just reread it recently, like when it came up as something perhaps we would talk about in this conversation, and I still stand by it, actually. I don't know that it needs anything else around it. And the reception of it was super interesting. So I sent it to my administrative team, and I sent it to the various people in my district who sort of oversee PD. And, you know, I shared it with my close colleagues. I think I put a copy of the journal out, you know, and I emailed to people when Kaleidoscope comes out. And so I got a lot of really positive feedback from, like, many angles. Like, my assistant principal was like, this is a great piece. I'm so glad you wrote it. It's so insightful. I agree with everything that's in here. And a couple of the people at the district level who